Chapter 6, Moldova. Inside the bus, it was cold as ice. It was still snowing outside, and not many people seemed to be going to Moldova that night. Only a few couples and a young woman with a son had arrived by the time we were about to take off. The bus driver was either saving gas or just didn't bother turning on the heat and light before taking off. No one was talking. The dim light from the Bucharest street outside was coming through the windows, providing just enough light for me to see the silhouettes of the people sitting in the seats in front of me. I was hiding deep inside my big winter jacket, observing my own breath turn to fog in front of me. It stuck on the window by my seat, and I drew a random pattern on it. The driver finally got in, and minutes later, we were on our way. He made sure to entertain his few passengers by playing some really tacky TV show on the small screen in the front. It was like a mix of James Bond, A-Team, and Walker, Texas Ranger, only in Russian and produced by a 16-year-old with a budget of a few hundred rubles. The volume was turned up to maximum to make sure that the guy all the way in the back of the bus didn't miss out on anything. During the 10-hour drive, we went through an amazing cascade of episodes, all seemingly having the same plot of everyone trying to shoot each other with toy guns for no particular reason. Robert told me about Moldova, preparing me for what we might experience there. The small, remote village had some interesting customs. I was expected to shake hands with every male person I met. If I met a group of guys and knew at least one of them, it would be considered an offense if I didn't shake hands with all of them, no matter the size of the group. Shaking hands with women should be highly refrained from, though. All they needed was a small nod and a hello. Smoking was reserved only for men, and everyone drank lots of alcohol with every meal. It already seemed like a very different place from most other places I would visit on the trip. Just as Robert was saying something about killing a chicken, I suddenly saw a wall of snow rising outside the front window of the bus, accompanied by a loud sound. It reminded me of the big snowplows in the winter mornings at home. I was not far off, as it seemed like the bus driver had been a little more focused on a shootout on the TV than driving, and was now plowing full speed into the big piles of snow next to the road. I instinctively posted my hands on the seat in front of me, flexing every muscle in my body, preparing for the impact. Fortunately, the snow provided a semi-soft landing, and we all survived, for a little while at least. The piles of snow we had hit on the right side of the bus were so high that we couldn't open the doors and get out. We were in the middle of nowhere in the Romanian countryside. I hadn't seen another car on the road for hours, and there was no cell phone signal. Furthermore, we were almost running out of chips and chocolate, and I was starving, so I figured it wouldn't take long until we would have to start eating our first passenger to survive. Out of nowhere, a tow truck showed up only a few minutes after we had crashed. It seemed extremely unlikely that it would be there at that time, but I didn't mind, really. It only took 5 minutes to pull us free from the snow. While waiting in the snow, the TV had been turned off, but the driver made sure to turn it on again as we continued our journey. Robert told me about his time in the village in Moldova as a Peace Corps volunteer. He had wrestled back in the United States and was eager to do some similar sports while working abroad. Once a year, the villages in the area hold a festival, and amongst the many strange activities is the annual wrestling tournament. The first year Robert got there, he was granted special permission to participate. As he got to the finals, it was declared a draw. It wouldn't look good if an outsider came in and beat the local heroes. He had to share the prize, a live sheep, with the other finalists and put on a barbecue for everyone. That same year, Sando swept the floor in the teens tournament, winning a rabbit. A cute little rabbit, to be eaten, of course. It was the start of the first ever jiu-jitsu training in the little village as Robert got his hands on some old gis and opened up a little gym in the local school. The bus stopped for a 10-minute break in a nameless city. I walked outside to take a look around. It was getting late, probably past midnight. There was no wind, and the snow fell silently on the empty, frosty streets around me. I walked slightly away from the bus. Tall, gray apartment towers were placed in what seemed like an endless row, going down along the street I was standing on. I couldn't see how many of them there were, as the last ones that my eyes could reach started to fade out in the mist of the dark night. A road sign pointing in all directions had 7 or 8 city names on it in Romanian. I didn't recognize a single one. For a few cold minutes, I stood completely still and listened to the silence. It felt like I was totally alone in an unknown world, as far away from home as I could be, another planet, an empty parallel universe. A traveling rush that had demanded effort and courage to achieve was released into my bloodstream. I enjoyed every second of it. It was my drug. About an hour later, we arrived at the Moldovan border. A few guards were standing outside in the dark, cold night. The snow had stopped. They were dressed for the occasion and looked exactly like I would picture border guards in Eastern Europe to look like. Big assault rifles, long dark green coats, and large furry hats pulled down to just above their eyebrows. The place was eerie and could have been any scene from a 1980s action movie where an agent tries to sneak past the border guards into Russian territory. We made it through without any interrogations or Kalashnikov shootouts, and a few hours later we arrived in Kabul, where we would spend the night. Getting off the bus, we were supposed to walk a few streets to Robert's friend's apartment. I was too tired to help out with the map, and Robert didn't seem to be good with directions, so we ended up getting a little bit lost on the streets of Kahul. It was 3 or 4 in the morning and the city was dead. The cold wind was biting my face and seemed to blow right through my thick winter jacket. A lone nightclub was open, but it didn't look like anyone was in there. 3 young police officers were patrolling the street nearby. They wore long black uniforms going all the way down to their big leather boots. Their shoulders were hunched to their ears and hands stuck well into their pockets to keep warm. The sound of their boots patrolling the sidewalk echoed on the walls of the once modern, now faded and worn out apartment buildings on the empty street and could be heard clearly from where we were standing. The orange lights from their cigarettes were becoming more visible as they approached us. Looking at their rough faces, I could tell that they probably had seen a tough thing or two already in their young lives. My guess was that they were around 20 years old or maybe even younger. They looked really scary to me, but Robert didn't think twice about asking them for directions. He had little luck though. We finally decided to call Naima for directions. Down the small dark alley next to the nightclub, then first staircase to the right in the building complex. I am sure the place didn't look as scary in the daytime, but walking around the apartment buildings that cold dark night, going up and down one falling apart staircase after the other, lit up by single light bulbs hanging from cords in the ceiling, listening to the echo of our voices and big rusty metal doors screeching as they opened and closed, I felt like I was in a first-person shooter computer game, out of ammo and desperately looking for a health pack before being found by enemy soldiers. We finally found Naima. She was waving a flashlight to signal her location and we walked quickly towards her in a pace that matched our excitement at finally finding our way out. Naima was probably the least likely type of person I would have expected to meet in a small Moldovan city that evening. She was a short and stocky African-American woman, probably somewhere in her 40s. She was from Kansas City and had an accent to prove it, a voice as loud as a gospel choir lead singer, a huge smile and cornrows in her hair. It was in the middle of the night, but she was full of energy and seemed really happy to have guests. Wearing her pink pajamas with little monkeys and peace signs on, she immediately started making soup and sandwiches for us while we inflated the air mattress in the living room. "There was a cat and a dog and a goose walking right into the kitchen," she was telling stories and laughing loudly from the kitchen while making French toast on the old stove. Robert was her friend from the Peace Corps. She had been doing social projects in Moldova for 2 years, specializing in domestic violence, and spoke Romanian fluently. I was really impressed by the energy of this woman, but I had to get some sleep, so I crawled into my sleeping bag and closed my eyes. It was another long bus ride the next day before we finally reached our destination. There were very few people on the muddy streets of the little village. We stayed in a small, simple house on a hill. It was built with tough materials and made to withstand the rough weather in the Moldovan winter. It was the size of a regular house and functioned as a miniature farm. In the front of the house were stables with sheep, chicken, geese, and rabbits. They had their own little winery, something almost all houses in the area had. Adjacent to the house was a small field where they grew vegetables and grapes. An energetic dog lived year-round outdoors in the small garden and slept in a little cold house built from old wooden planks. I stood in the snow with toes freezing, overlooking the field in front of the house. There was a full panoramic view over the area, hills with small farmhouses, a little forest, a river, and a small patch of buildings all covered in snow. I wondered how beautiful it would look in the summer when everything was green and all the colorful vegetables and grapes were growing. A few small wooden chairs were placed in the garden, just waiting for summer where someone would sit in them and enjoy the tranquility. Tulia greeted us at the door with a strong handshake. He lived in the house with his mother. His father had passed away. He was my age, but looked a bit older. The rough faces told stories of hard manual labor since childhood. I had just been playing football and sitting in front of a computer. We all sat there on the couch in the quiet living room. It was exactly as quiet as the village outside. Tolia broke the silence and asked if I wanted to kill a chicken the next day so we could eat it for dinner. I had never killed an animal and the thought didn't appeal to me at all. But I decided that if I could eat meat from animals my whole life, then I couldn't just close my eyes to the fact that I also agreed on killing them. Doing it myself would be a healthy thing. I said yes. There was a short debate over whether it should be a chicken or a rabbit whose life I would have the honor of ending. I got a lump in my throat, thinking about my beloved rabbit I had as a kid. No, I couldn't do that. I had to start with the chicken, which made me nervous enough. Small steps. There was a very narrow spiral staircase in the middle of the living room floor, going down to a kitchen and heating room. A big concrete fireplace was built into the foundation of the house itself, providing heat to the upper floor. I felt cold from the bus ride and the walk outside, so it was nice to lean against the rustic wall, enclosing the fireplace and feel warmth return to my limbs. Now and then Tulia would try with a little bit of English. He was actually pretty good, but obviously lacked training and confidence in speaking. In Soviet times, there was no sex, only family. If someone asked where the children came from, people said they got them from the Communist Party, he joked. An old sports hall had a prominent location in the middle of the village. Tolea had told me that when he was a kid, it was a thriving place with sports events and training going on all the time. There had been wrestling competitions and many tough boxing matches had been fought. He had played football there himself as a kid. When the union fell, the funding ended and the building was left to fall apart. People in the village took whatever they could use from it. When I got there, only the ruins were left of what must have been a magnificent place. There were no locks on the doors and no glass in the windows. Walking into the entrance hall, it struck me how beautiful it must have looked in its prime. The walls were white and blue, most of the paint had fallen off. I walked through the main entrance and found the locker room. So many athletes must have waited in those small rooms before going into the hall to perform. There were four rooms, two for the home team and two for the away team. Walking from the locker rooms, a small corridor went into the hall itself. When I first walked this way, I could imagine how it must have been for the wrestlers, boxers and gymnasts doing the same. Nervous, anxious, listening to the sound of the audience inside the hall ahead. Entering the big room, the first thing I noticed was the light coming through the enormous windows on the opposite wall. There was no glass left, just big rectangular holes. The light must have filled the room beautifully. Above the floor was the spectator balcony with people cheering for the athletes. On one wall was written, "Raise high the flag of sport," and on the other, the Olympic rings and motto, "Faster, higher, stronger." I wonder how many dreams of young athletes have been dreamed in that building. Dreams of reaching the top, becoming the best they could, making their families and country proud. Standing there was a very special thing to me. It was not hard to imagine the tense atmosphere before a big game or match. When I closed my eyes, I could see how it must have looked. I was desperately hoping I'd go back in time when I opened them again. But there was nothing. The paint had still fallen off and the silence was stunning. The wind blew gently through the big windows, silently carrying a few big snowflakes with it. A tree was growing in one corner. The wooden floor was long gone, probably used for firewood many years earlier. There were no more breathtaking seconds of victory and defeat there. No more dreams. Robert shouted something to me from the outside as he came down the hill towards the building. I shook my head and blinked my eyes a few times, coming back to the real world. My answer echoed off the concrete walls of the empty hall as I shouted back to him out through the big empty windows. A former theater, now being used as a youth center, was right around the corner in a building connected to the sports hall. A few drunken men were looking out at us through a window. They were probably living in one of the rooms in the building, or at least using it for something. We walked up a once prominent staircase to the front door. No shows were on at the theater at the moment, and probably wouldn't be for a while. It was being used as a place for young people to hang out. About 10 guys in their teens were smoking cigarettes in one of the rooms. The air was thick with smoke. They had a ping pong table and were playing intensely while shouting and laughing loudly, probably trash talking each other. It seemed like they were having a good time. They looked rough. Their faces were hard to see with their beanies pulled down and hands held in front of their mouths to be warmed by their breath. Robert shook hands with all of them, and I remembered the custom of doing the same. They looked at me strangely. It felt awkward. The boy said there would be a disco in the evening. Before I even got to consider it, Robert had told me that we would come. I wondered how the local guys would look at me when I showed up at their party. In the adjacent room, three guys were playing pool. There was a big scratch in the middle of the table, and the little nets in each hole had been worn out long ago, so the balls just fell directly on the wooden floor with a loud bang every time someone hit the hole. We shook hands with everyone, and I quickly put my gloves back on. The youth center was cold as ice. I wanted to get back to the nice warm fireplace in the house. The day after what had been the coldest night out of my life at the local bar, basically just a large freezer with plastic chairs and gigantic vodka shots, we went to visit the school. The kids had a break between classes as we got there, and hordes of them were running around hallways and staircases. I had never had so many eyes stare at me at once before. It was like every kid running around completely froze as they discovered I was there. Then they just stared at me like I was some rare animal. In some way, I guess I was. I met the school principal and all the other teachers. They were excited to have guests. I had shaken hundreds of hands and had gotten pretty used to it until I decided to go to the bathroom. Back at the house, the toilet was a little shed in the garden with a hole in the ground and nothing else. I had been a little hesitant about using it, so I thought that the school must have better facilities. It didn't. The outdoor toilet was like something out of a Saw movie. It was the most disgusting and scary place I'd ever been to in my life. I think many of us have bad memories about schoolyard toilets as kids. They were smelly, and I was always afraid of the older boys who could come in any time and try to play an evil prank on the younger ones, looking over the door or trying to open the lock with a pair of scissors. What a paradise I'd grown up in compared to these toilets. I instantly regretted and took back every bad memory I had from my childhood as I saw the five holes in the stone floor lined up in the small room. Knee-high concrete walls divided the holes to provide minimum privacy. There was no running water, no sinks, no soap, and no paper. Only five holes in the ground. Feces were lying on the floor, mostly around the holes from when someone had missed them and didn't feel like kicking it down. There were brown foot and handprints on the wall. I didn't want to think too much about how it got there. I felt terrible for the kids who had to go through 10 years of school using these. We went back to rest before the class in the afternoon when school was out. We met the mayor on the way, who was intrigued by having a tourist in his village and invited us to dinner at his house. Unfortunately, we already had plans to visit Sandro's parents' house. Regardless, we now had enough dinner invitations that I didn't have to kill that chicken anyways. I was relieved but a little disappointed at the same time. It was a challenge I would have to take up again another time in the future. In the afternoon, about 15 boys were waiting for us outside the school. They looked a little nervous. They had been looking forward to having someone come from outside their small community to teach them. It was a big thing for them, and for me. Sandu had the keys for the school. Some old dirty mats were pulled out from a small storage space. After Robert had left and Sandu had moved to Bucharest, there hadn't been much training going on at the school. They had a pile of old geese that a friend of Robert's had collected in the US and shipped over. There was no money for the villagers to buy any themselves, so the help from abroad made the training possible. Not a single of them fit or was intact. They were ripped, dirty, too big, and full of holes. A few belts were actual training belts. The rest were reused pieces of fabric or furry belts from ropes. The boys didn't seem to care one bit. They grabbed whatever they could and ran into the gym hall, shouting and laughing, excited to train again. Walking into the gym hall, I immediately knew that this was not going to be like any other training I would do on the trip. Probably not like any other training I would do in my life. There was no heating. It was just as cold as being outside in the snow. The walls were painted green many years ago and the floor was old and broken. It had big holes in it and some places entire boards were missing. There was no money for a football goal, so they had painted one on the wall with chalk instead. I couldn't imagine playing football there. More than one kid must have broken a foot stepping into those holes. There was originally no light in the room, but someone had stolen 6 street lamps and installed them instead. The kids were wearing their thick sweatshirts and pants under the geese. I had to keep my socks, beanie and gloves on, as well as a few t-shirts. Sandu was laying out the mats while Robert showed some of the boys how to tie the belts, and I tried to get a little bit warm. It was impossible. I was freezing to the very marrow of my bones. I took a few photos with my camera, and the boys were eager to pose for me. I asked one of them to do a portrait. The gi jacket he was wearing reached all the way down to below his knees, and the pants had been cut with a pair of scissors so they fit his length. He was wearing a turtleneck sweater, socks, and a thick beanie. He seemed very proud that I would take his photo. Only him alone, no one else in the photo. As he stood there on the broken floor in front of the wall with the green paint falling off, I couldn't really determine if he was smiling or being serious. There was a slight smile on his face, but at the same time, having his portrait taken was something he took very seriously. I clicked the button and immediately realized that it was one of the best portraits I would take on the trip. A split second later, he was gone, playing with the other boys. I called everyone together and Robert made a brief introduction about me. The boys were completely quiet, sitting around on the cold mats. I tried to do some warm-up with them, but it was impossible to break a sweat, so I decided to give up on that. We started training, and I did some of the drills I do with my own kids' team at home. They absolutely loved it. I made squares with belts, and we did a simple wrestling drill, where two at a time the kids try to push each other out, and the winner stays in. Then I showed them some escapes and simple chokes from mount and back mount. They were having a great time and seemed eager to learn something. Their physiques were impressive. I could tell they had been doing hard labor most of their lives already. Driving through on double legs seemed very natural to them, and they had a lot of power, catching me by surprise a few times. I wish I had the opportunity to work more with them. If only I had just 6 months with them in my gym back home, they would be absolute monsters in competition. These were really poor kids, living in such a different world than my own. They didn't have much, no iPods, no cell phones, no fancy clothes, and no heating. But it didn't seem to matter a bit to them. It didn't make any difference at all. For a few hours, they seemed to forget all that and just get lost in training, like we all do every day we go to the gym at home. They were smiling and laughing so much. Every time they laughed, a big white fog appeared in front of them in the cold air, and it was like I was the only one who noticed the cold. I loved every second of it, and was desperately trying to hold on to the feeling they gave me so I could keep it forever. Only 2 of the 6 streetlights in the ceiling were working, so I had to show techniques in the one corner that was lit up. My knee was hurting, and I still hadn't been able to warm it up, but I wanted to make sure I rolled with everyone anyways. When it got too dark to spar safely, we decided to call it a day. My toes and fingers were completely numb from the cold at that point. It was a big honor to train with those kids, and something that I will never forget. That day, I really had my eyes open to what power I possessed to influence people in a positive way with jiu-jitsu. Giving kids good experiences and being a role model for someone is a huge gift, and it is important to use it right. Although, I know that I somehow do the same at home, but this was different. I came from faraway lands, completely unknown, and still I was able to have a positive influence on someone, maybe even change their lives a little bit in a positive way. I wished I could do just this on the whole trip around the world. Visiting famous gyms and training with world champion superstars suddenly seemed so unimportant. It had been the coldest, but at the same time, the most inspirational training session of my life. We stayed a few more days in the village, and I started to feel at home there. Sandro started to become a friend, and he tried more and more with English phrases. In Romania, we had barely said a word to each other, and I had thought it would have been awkward to have him with us for so long. I looked back and remembered his face in the Bucharest class. He was one in 40 white belts there, and I didn't take special notice of him. Now things were different, and we had a special connection. We could communicate a little, but it worked out really well when Robert translated. He was young and extremely enthusiastic about jiu-jitsu. In class, he worked with discipline and sucked in every bit of information he could. Besides that, he was strong as an ox, and his base and balance was so good that it was extremely difficult for me to sweep him. After dinner at his family's house our last evening, we walked home in the frosty snow. I hadn't changed my clothes or showered for 4 days. Same socks and same underwear. It didn't matter. The sky was clear and thousands of stars were visible. We were far away from any light pollution. It was freezing cold and the air was dry. The moon was out and lit up the snow on the road. No one said anything on the way home. I looked up at the stars, thinking about the kids. I would be leaving the next morning, but they were not going anywhere. They would be sitting in that gym hall with no heating. I had a tear in my eye. Whether it was from the cold, dry air or from thinking about the unexpected experiences and friendships I had found in the little village, I couldn't tell. Sitting in the rattling morning bus on our way from the village to Chișinău, the capital of Moldova, I couldn't get a sentence out of my head that Robert had written to me in an email a few weeks back. I've been in contact with the guy in Chișinău, and it sounds like they are all but rolling out the red carpet for you. That means that they will try and test you. This is kind of the Russian mentality. I didn't feel like being tested by any crazy Russians. My knee agreed, but there was nothing to do but to go there and see what would happen. Ivan, one of the guys from a traditional jiu-jitsu gym, picked us up at the bus station. I had just had one of the worst hamburgers of my life there and didn't feel extremely well. Having gotten up early and been sitting on the bus all day, all I could think about was rest. The city looked cold and depressing, much like Bucharest. A guy was sitting on a bench with an old scale in front of him on the ground, offering to weigh people for less than 10 cents. A woman stood on a street corner and sold colorful balloon animals. She looked sad. The guys had big plans for my short visit. We were going directly to do a class in the gym, then teach a seminar for 100 people in a large sports hall. They had even printed seminar t-shirts with my name on it. I was taken a little by surprise there. I hadn't really thought about what I was going to do in Chișinău, so having to teach 2 seminars right off the bus just seemed like too much. I decided that training was what I was traveling for anyway, so I accepted the challenge. I could rest the following day instead. Robert had couch-surfed in Chișinău before, and he hooked us up with the guy he stayed with the last time. Sergei lived in a big apartment with his mom, and he was making money buying and selling women's shoes off eBay. He was in his late teens and a bit dorky. When I first introduced myself to him, he was really curious about what kind of Christian I was, because he was a Catholic himself. I was confused for a second, and it didn't get less complicated when I told him that I wasn't religious at all. I don't really remember how I got out of that conversation. My brain was fried from traveling all morning, and I tried to sneak around Sergei's many questions. We had to get going. I was teaching 15 minutes later in the gym, and I almost couldn't keep my eyes open. Almost everyone spoke nothing but Russian, so one of the guys had to translate every time I said something. It took ages to explain the details of every position. Both me and Robert were totally overtired and couldn't stop laughing and joking about everything. We were like kids. I had no idea how I was going to survive a seminar for 100 people only a few hours later. Later was becoming sooner, and directly from the gym, we went to have dinner and then to the sports hall where the seminar would be. My second class of the day after having been in town for less than 3 hours. It was a huge building from the Soviet times. Like the sports hall in the village, it was deteriorating, though to nowhere near the same extent. We walked through the hallway towards the wrestling hall. Old photos of wrestling teams were hanging on the wooden walls. Lots of guys were waiting for us, and I was introduced to a bunch of them in the hallway. They looked pretty badass, and some of the handshakes were among the hardest I'd felt in my life. I couldn't stop thinking about what Robert had said in the email. Were they hardcore Sambo guys who were going to test my skills and rip my kneecaps off? I knew they did lots of leg locks, and I was extremely worried about my injury. The wrestling hall itself was the biggest I've ever seen. There was at least 10 meters to the ceiling, and the room fitted 3 full-size wrestling mats. Large posters in Russian from wrestling competitions were hanging on the wall. The ceiling was leaking, and buckets were strategically placed around the hall. In one place, the water was dripping down on the wall, making the paint wet and loose. I accidentally put my hand on it and got a handful of paint that I had to go wash off. A lot of guys were changing into their geese, and a lot of eyes seemed to be on me. I was starting to get used to that, though. I had no idea what to expect. The black belts of the jiu-jitsu organization looked tough. It could have been a who's who of Russian James Bond bad guys. I was having all kinds of nightmares in my mind about how they would throw me around in crazy submissions and injure every joint in my body. I still didn't feel fully comfortable about sparring with complete strangers yet. My mind tried to play too many tricks on me. It was something I hoped to get better at coping with during my trip. I started explaining a little bit about what I intended to teach. I usually make lots of jokes when I teach, but it seemed like no matter how hard I tried, no one even smiled. They were just sitting there with stone serious faces. Even the 20 or so kids, who I would have expected to be totally unfocused. I tried so hard, but I just couldn't get a reaction from them. Robert laughed now and then in the awkward silence, and it didn't make our silly, overtired mood any better. I had people do some difficult body mechanics drills, followed by classics such as the around the world drill, where one guy has to climb all the way around his standing partner without falling off. Usually, when people try this first and fail, they get frustrated and start laughing. This time, I didn't hear a sound. People would try hard to do it, and when they failed, they wouldn't have any expression on their faces. They just tried again. To me, training should first and foremost be fun and enjoyable. If I don't enjoy training and have a good time, I will end up quitting sooner than later. I decided to focus the whole seminar around trying to make people laugh instead of actually teaching them jiu-jitsu techniques. That part would have to wait. Explaining the rules of a game I would play with the kids would usually make them smile a little bit. Here, they looked like I was explaining how to play a casino card game where their entire retirement savings were on the line. Eventually, I had 40 grown-up men play Jiu-Jitsu Virus in a desperate attempt to put a smile on their faces. It eventually worked. Everyone wanted a go at me and Robert in sparring, and we were put to work. My worst fears of Russians dumping me on the head and blowing out my knees were all in my head. There was nothing to be afraid of, and I handled myself well. I wanted to make a point about the importance of positional dominance, so every time I rolled, I made sure to slowly switch between positions and not let people escape them. They would get really tired from trying, and in the end, I could apply a submission with no effort, even on the biggest guys. It was old-school Gracie tactics, and I think it proved my point. The head of the organization was a very big short-haired guy with a worn-out black belt. He owned the gym I taught in earlier and was highly respected by everyone in the room. He was incredibly strong and probably about 30 kilos heavier than me. Luckily for me, he had never been exposed to the Brazilian style of grappling before, and I could fairly easily sweep, hold, and submit him. From my experience, if someone is high in a hierarchy, especially in the more traditional martial arts, then often they don't feel good about looking bad or losing in front of their own students. I think that in most cases, the guy would have retreated at that point, pretending to be tired, injured, or something so he wouldn't have to lose more. This time it was different. He wanted more. He concentrated to pronounce the English word, again, just right. I couldn't get him off of me. Everyone in the room had started to sit in a circle around us on the mat to watch as their master was submitted by a much smaller guy again and again. As we got home from the seminar, I was completely done after the long day. I had nothing left in me. Sergei kept asking questions about everything in the world, it seemed, and I didn't want to just come and take advantage of his hospitality, so I politely answered as many as I could. He didn't understand how the triangle choke technique worked. He had seen it in the UFC, but never used it in his karate training and wanted me to demonstrate it for him. It was way past midnight, and I was triangling a guy I had just met on the living room floor in an apartment in a former Soviet Union country. I'd had enough impressions for one day. It was definitely time to go to bed. Robert had planned a trip for us to Transnistria, a place people told me is located somewhere between Dracula and Chernobyl. I was honestly a little nervous about going to a country that, according to Wikipedia, didn't officially exist. If something happened there, would I be able to get out again? A quick look online made it sound like a lawless place controlled by ruthless Russian military warlords. Robert was, as usual, not bothered at all by this and seemed to be able to move around freely in any dangerous and unknown territory without even thinking twice about it. We went to the little local market to buy tickets for the bus. They handed us customs papers that we needed to fill out for the border control. I once again found myself in a cold small van, and the drive would take about 45 minutes. Robert told me that some guys had built a homemade raft and used it to cross the river to Transnistria to steal some watermelons. They got caught and are probably still in jail. I guess they really felt like having watermelons that day. As we arrived at the border, a uniformed guard entered the van and collected everyone's passports. We waited about 20 minutes before he returned. He said something in Russian, and a few people from the bus walked out. We didn't understand anything, but a guy sitting next to us spoke a little English and explained that all foreigners had to go to the customs office to apply for a tourist visa. There was a long line in the small building without any windows. Different forms were lying around on tables, and instructions in Russian were posted on the wall next to wanted posters of criminals. They were probably more watermelon thieves, I thought. Through a small hole in a window, a very serious border guard was processing the visa requests from people in the line. He was taking his time. The room he was sitting in was about five times the size as the small one we were waiting in. It was completely empty except for his desk, an old beige computer with a CRT monitor, and one of those old keyboards with a curled cord and a click sound for each key press. The walls were mint green, and the only thing on them was a big Transnistrian flag with hammer and sickle hanging in the back of the room, reminding everyone who was ruling the border. There was absolutely no expression on his face as he typed in the information from the passports. I slowly moved forward in the line and was feeling a little nervous about the whole situation. Would he be suspicious that I was a tourist? And what about Robert, who was American? I handed the border guard my passport and the form, hoping I had filled it out correctly. He didn't look up from the screen as he picked it up. Rarely had I seen such an expressionless face. He started entering my information in the computer. It seemed to take forever. Then he suddenly asked me, with a deep voice and a heavy Russian accent, if I was going back the same evening. I was. Still not looking at anything but the screen, he put my passport back on the little desk in front of me together with a stamped entry visa for the day. "Good luck," he said, with a voice so deep and rough that it could make even Arnold Schwarzenegger shiver with fear. What? Why would I need luck? For a moment I was a little confused, and at the same time it was hard for me not to smile or laugh at the absurdity of the situation. I took a photo of the little piece of paper with the stamp on, proving that I could enter the country of Transnistria for one day and one day only. I hoped that I wouldn't be late for the last bus back to Chișinău. Driving into the city of Tiraspol, I noticed that surprisingly many buildings and shops had a big sign saying Sheriff. Apparently some super rich guy owned most of the country, including the football team, gas station and supermarkets. To make everything easier, he decided to give everything the same name. It was a strange place. We got off the bus at the Sheriff supermarket, located right next to the Sheriff football stadium. Robert had stayed in Tiraspol with a guy called Andrei for a few days, and we decided to go visit him. After walking around a little bit, we found the area where he lived. It was a badass Soviet ghetto. Naked trees in the snow were lined up between a handful of identical concrete buildings with rusty caged windows and faded yellow balconies. Laundry in all colors was hanging to dry outside the windows, and there was no one on the street. We found Andrei's apartment. It was on the fourth floor and very spacious. He had a kind wife, a kid, and a small dog. They invited us in for a cup of tea in their simple kitchen. It was cozy and didn't feel at all like what I had in mind after reading Wikipedia the day before. Andrei had studied German, which allowed him to travel to Switzerland. He worked as a translator and ran a German internet radio with news from Transnistria. I only spoke German when I was drunk. He told us that in Soviet times, translating any movies in a foreign language was illegal. The translators were arrested and prosecuted. People still wanted to watch American and European movies, so to hide their identity, the underground translators held their noses while recording. Visiting a home in such an isolated country in a world so different from my own felt like a very big privilege. Having guests like me and Robert was their window to the rest of the world, as we came from a place that was impossible for them to visit themselves. I thought about how lucky I was that I didn't need any visa or have any worries if I wanted to go somewhere in the world. I took the freedom of travel for granted, but it was ignorant of me. For Andrei and his family, traveling anyway outside of their miniature country was virtually impossible. They had to let the world come to them, so with the internet radio and inviting people into their homes through couchsurfing, they got a glimpse of the world outside and were able to hear about it from people who lived there. They were extremely hospitable and very interested in hearing about Denmark. I felt sad for them. They hoped for a better and freer future, especially for their young daughter, Andrei told me. I would never take my freedom to travel for granted again. The whole little family, with all their dreams and visions for the future, was standing in the falling apart doorway, waving goodbye to us and offering for us to come back anytime as we walked down the stairs from the apartment. I wished I could have taken them with me to see the world. The only thing I could do was to make sure I went out there and took in all the experiences I could, getting the absolute most of it, being open to everything and not taking anything for granted. Anything else would be a disgrace towards those people who were unable to do it, people like those I had just met. We met up with Ivan at a cafe. He was really excited about his first experience with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu the day before and couldn't stop talking about it. Coming from a traditional Jiu-Jitsu background, it seemed to have been a real eye-opener for him. There was a lot of information and thoughts for him and his training partners to process, but I had a feeling that when I would come back one day, things would be very different and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu would be a fast-growing sport. The seed was planted, now it was just a question of time. Robert took the bus with me to the airport. People would jump on and find a seat. Then they would tap the shoulder of the person sitting in front of them and ask them to pass on their money for the driver. If someone got the back seat, their little handful of coins and notes would be passed through the entire bus before reaching the driver. He would then send the change back through the bus. Since I was sitting in the front, I was being tapped on the shoulder the entire way. The airport was almost empty when I got there. It felt like they had built it with shops and everything just for me to fly to Turkey that day. No one else seemed to use it. An empty cafeteria had a TV showing Banged Up Abroad, a show about people getting caught in airports smuggling drugs and thrown in scary jails. It was almost like a message to the passengers not to try anything stupid. Sitting in the plane, I wondered how the rest of the trip could possibly top what I had seen and experienced in Eastern Europe. It had really changed my view on how I would travel in the months to come and even for the rest of my life. I needed to stay focused on getting out and seeing the real world, not just the big cities with airports which are often just a variation of the world I already know. I had to seriously push myself to see another side of the world and experience the lives of real people in real places. It was too comfortable to travel safe. I could easily go around the world like that, but I wanted more. With an overwhelming excitement to see what awaited me out in the world, I put in my earplugs and curled up under my little blanket on the airport seat. I felt at home in planes and fell asleep right away.